Let me be precise.
Oh man, I love a show that starts on time, and I can see our comment section is already well into it, even before the show started this morning, with loads of comments being thrown around about our star guest today, and she really is a star guest, one of those people who has never held her mouth, she's never held back, she's always got something to say, and we love her. She's Helen Ziller, and lots of people absolutely cannot stand Helen Ziller when they see her, when they hear her. They have like a knee-jerk reaction of the most extraordinary kind. But we've got lots to catch up with her about, because I think the last time we spoke to her on this show, Pumi, was probably a couple of months
ago. A long time ago.
Oh, before the election even.
It wasn't before the election. I feel like it wasn't. No, it was a long time ago.
Even longer before then.
Longer before then. So
in the first age. So, before Pumi, how are you?
Good morning. I have my hot cup of coffee. So I hope to catch up with the comment section this morning, because they are on fire already. So I hope I'm awake enough for them. I overslept this morning, but I made it on time.
Well, they are on fire. I mean, Hermin already says, lol, for a second I thought Pumi was Helen. God, I was so confused. Oh man. All right, so we've got lots.
Let's get it going. There's a lot to cover, because again, another crazy, crazy South African week. Another crazy South African week. Guys.
Well, we've got lots to talk about with regard to the GNU, which was 100 days this week, and they've survived longer than some people thought they would, with their 100-day mark being passed. Some ministers kicking ass and taking numbers, other ones just quietly staying under the radar. And we're likely to experience a lot of that going forward, I'm sure. Some of the municipalities are falling to pieces as we speak too, and we're going to find out from Helen what she thinks of that. There's plenty going on in the news. I don't know if you've been, if you've seen the comment. Suddenly, a guy called Randall Williams, who was actually the former mayor of Tshwane, Pretoria, he suddenly got on a soapbox and started ranting and raving this week about how he was forced to report to Celia Brink, even though Celia Brink wasn't the mayor at the time and had no place in the structures. He was an ordinary councillor. I'm not entirely sure I understand what his beef is, but we'll maybe get some clarity on that from Helen. And of course, the president is fresh back from the UN, where he said absolutely nothing of value. You know, it's funny to me, like he gets there to the United Nations and he speaks of we South Africans who side with Palestine. And I thought to myself, you can't really say that anymore. You have like 40% of South Africa behind you. You got to be super careful about what you promise people, because you're no longer in a position where you can say, well, more than half of the people agree with me. You're now one of the minority parties. There isn't a majority party in this country. You know, and he gets up and he has, you know, has plenty to say moralizing about our position in the world. Of course, what's happened internationally in the last couple of days has been nothing short of extraordinary either, with rockets being fired from Iran directly into Israel, with Israel making incursions into southern Lebanon, lots of fire between the two, Nasrallah of Hezbollah completely displaced and probably dismembered. So the entire top structure of Hezbollah, the feared Hezbollah, who we were told were far more dangerous than Hamas in the south, didn't take long for Israel to completely dismantle them. And that absolutely stunning and incredible thing, which I just can't get enough of talking about this, these pages and that whole story around the pages and then the walkie-talkies, you kind of think to yourself, I don't know that there has been this level of incredible state subterfuge and intelligence and just long planning. I mean, we're talking about plans that were put into play probably 5 to 10 years ago and only came to fruition this year. The kinds of contingencies you would have to build into a plan like that are just mind-boggling. And whether you are a fan of Israel or not, you've got to admit, it is absolutely the most incredible move by any government against any other political organization, probably in history.
You know, watching this week reminded me a little bit like when shock and awe started. It was the same sensation. I was sitting on the couch and have been flipping through. And now it's not flipping through the news channels. It's flipping through various kind of YouTube commentators, right? And there's a guy that I found who is in Britain, is Iranian, is of Iranian descent. I think his parents are Iranian, but he's been raised in Britain. And he has a lot of on-the-ground footage that he keeps like scrolling through. Mm-hmm. And it was really did remind me of when we first saw that war kick off. And yes. And it's been shocking on so many levels and devastating. And obviously everybody is speaking about how this kind of escalation does not bode well for the rest of the world, because just like with World War II and with World War I before that, because of all these varying alliances, the kind of people that keep getting pulled into the conflict is where the problem is, right? And to watch Iran launch their ballistic missiles was also, for me, I did not think they had it in them, because for the longest time, Iran really has had their hand in the pocket saying, I've got a big gun. And don't make me pull it out.
And for the longest time also, their big gun was their proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas. By the way, I just want to address this quickly. Surviving Life says, your views on Israel, Palestine, and Republicans, Democrats are skewed, Gareth. Try to be nonpartisan. You lose people when you're biased. I have no horse in either race, just saying. Well, if you wanted that, go to someone who calls themselves a journalist. I'm not. I have very strong views on both of those issues. I have strong views about a lot of things. If you come here for objective journalism, I've got bad news for you. That's not what we do. We're here with loads of opinion. So I think you've just maybe found the wrong place, Surviving Life, and maybe it's time for you to move on and find something else.
Oof, blinking lights in the studio.
Well, so maybe they're rockets, you know?
But and now it seems they have pulled out their big gun, right? They have pulled out their big gun. So they've taken off the table the thing that we were all so afraid of for so long.
I mean, does this mean that they've lost the threat of being a credible opponent here? Does this mean that they've now expended all of their fear capital? Because that was really the reason that so many people said, oh, don't disturb the balance of power in the Middle East. And now we've seen it disturbed. And actually, it's exactly what it was for Israel before.
Look, and now, you know, I was explaining to somebody yesterday, I was actually explaining to my brother that if you consider that what Hamas and Hezbollah are, they're kind of like, if you remember, the AWB had a military wing, right? No, seriously, that's who they are. They're like a military wing of an organization within a country. But now you have a country, Iran, that has come into this war, where before you had the AWB's military wing going into Zimbabwe. Essentially, that's what you had, right? So it was, but now you have state players. You now have Iran has actually attacked state to state Israel, and so it's also a different phase and a different faction of what we're looking at. And Iran Israel has pulled Iran into this war. They really have goaded them into the war. So by going after Hezbollah, who were formed by the Iranian Republican Guard, right? Hezbollah had to do something. Iran had to do something. They had to do something or they were going to lose face. But I don't know if they wanted to get into the war.
I'm for people like Langelihle, who says fighting in that region has been happening since humans arrived. We are in no position to involve ourselves. Loss of human life is sad. Yes, but that's the most banal statement possible. And none of it helps us to interpret the fact that this is probably the biggest story in the world right now. We're trying to make sense of it. I do think it's hilarious. The difference between a state like Israel, which pulled off that pager thing, what did they call it? Operation Dead Ringer or something like that. The difference between that, the level of smart, you know, that was going on there. And then you compare that to like all the scooters with flags on that took to the streets of Beirut, you know, the feared 47th scooter brigade of mm-hmm. Hezbollah. And Iran, who managed with all of those rockets that we've seen being fired over the last 2-3 days, they managed to kill one person, and it was a Palestinian sitting on the street who got squashed by a rocket that fell. I mean, it's just embarrassing how bad they are. So there are differences. Some states are first world states that have the ability to actually conduct high-tech, incredibly focused, strategic strike war. And you get people who are like lobbing around missiles and hoping that they hit something, sort of spray and pray, quite literally. So I just think anybody who says when, you know, country A arrives at the UN, because the UN had their General Assembly last week, and country B arrives at the UN, they're equal. And both of these countries must be given an equal amount of time and an equal amount of precedence and status. They don't. No, actually, some countries are really stupid and backward. And again, I've got to make the distinction here between Iran and the people who run it at the moment, you know, the Ayatollah and the Iranian Republican Guard, and the actual people of Iran, who are not stupid and backward. And the people of Iran who frankly, you can see inside Iran when they allow some footage out or when someone on social media is able to use a VPN and do that. You can see that the people of Iran are not a bunch of monolithic, backward, religious nutcases who are willing to die for the Ayatollah. And indeed, you see quite the opposite. You see a very diverse, thoughtful, very interesting population who perhaps have found themselves under the yoke of people whose priorities are not their happiness, safety, and security and prosperity, but just the destruction of Israel, which maybe most Iranians don't care about.
As you know, I mean, I have been to Tehran. I've spent time there. And I when I came back, one of the overriding thoughts that I always had was how wrong we are about the people that are living there. And the fact that, I mean, 2 years ago, we were on this very show talking about people standing up, trying to stand up from under this repressive regime. And it's fascinating for me to watch now as suddenly on social media, on various platforms where people are talking about what's happening, suddenly Iran are the good guys. And I'm just like, the hell? What the hell is going on? And if anything reminds you of how vile humans can be, it's watching all of this play out. All right.
Well, I do want us to bring on our guest, because I was just making sure that she was ready to go. And she, of course, is, because she's a pro. She's done this a million times. I've seen her take on some, in inverted commas, journos in the last couple of weeks and really put them in their place. So let's hope it's a friendly encounter for us, Pums. Here is none other than Helen Ziller of the Federal Council of the Democratic Alliance. Helen, it's good to see you. How are you?
It's great to be with you, Gareth and Pumi. Really good. I'm well at this time of the morning. I see there's a lot of glare on my glasses.
Yeah, anyway, it looked quite scary for a second there, but don't worry. Some people think you're. I know. Some people think you're scary no matter what you do, glare or not. Okay, so can I start off, Pums, just by.
Where do you want to start? Because you're in Tshwane.
Well, okay, so we will start with Tshwane in a moment, but just let's cast our mind back, because I do think Pumi's right. We last spoke to you well in advance of the election, Helen. So I want to give you credit, because Sihle Ngobese, who was on last week, actually said this, and it's what a lot of people perhaps acknowledge but don't want to say out loud, is that you predicted what we've got at the moment. Whether you engineered this because you're some sort of Machiavellian genius, or whether you just had a better handle on South African politics than most of the commentariat who have let themselves down disgustingly in our mainstream press, you got it right. You said 4 years ago already The way this is going to unfold in a couple of years' time is that there will be an alliance, an uncomfortable one, but there'll be a kind of coming together of the ANC and the DA. You said this. Take some credit. I want you to take a bow because no one else is going to give you a chance to do that.
Thank you very much. Well, it's really not that I want to take a bow in any way at all, but when I was a journalist, one of the big skills we were taught was to spot the trends, to understand what forces were moving the society, and then to follow them through with all the variables that there were. And I've been in politics a very long time now, and I can spot the trends and I see where the forces are moving. And in 2019, I said exactly this. I said, in 5 years' time, the ANC is going to get around 40% of the vote. We're going to get around 20% of the vote. And then the critical thing is that we are going to have to get into an alliance with the ANC. And I think I said to keep out the far left. So that's on record. And the irony was that Herman Mashaba had Funzi Ngubeni tape that because he was in the conversation with me and he was goading me out to say that and to give my prediction of what would happen in 2024. And they recorded that to embarrass me, to say that they were going to release that. And they did release that, certainly shortly before every election since then, to say, well, the DA is going to go into a deal with the ANC. Now, that's not what I actually said. I said, we will to keep out the far left, because that'll be essential. So the critical thing is that they took that little snippet of my analysis to say that in 2024, the ANC would get 40%, we would get about 20%, and then we would do some kind of an alliance with them. They took that little bit out to say, if you vote for the DA, you're voting for the ANC, which of course is not true.
That's worked out so well for Action SA, hasn't it? I mean, they've really shot the lights out, just absolutely killing it. Herman Mashaba attacked me the other day because I said, I live in Tswane, and this is what Pumi wants us to get to, and the mayor has been removed. Which is not an unusual thing in Tswane. This has happened a couple of times. Mayor's been votes of no confidence have been leveled against various mayors of various parties, sometimes by the DA, sometimes of the DA. And I said this, and Herman Mashaba said to me, oh, you know, you should apologize for 1948. Of course, I'm so old that I was born before 1948 and had some hand in politics before then. And that the municipality should come after me because I threatened a tax revolt. Just because I'm sick to death of seeing politicians prioritize themselves over the taxpaying citizens of this city. And I said in response to him, well, it's always nice to upset the mayor of the 125th biggest party in the country. So that's where we are at.
Yeah, just like you. Well, Gareth, look, let me put that into context in Tswane.
Yeah, please.
If all the good citizens and true in Tswane, who voted for all of the tiny little parties, many of which got only one seat each, but Herman got 19 seats. If all of those had voted for us, we would have been by far the biggest party and we would have fixed Tswane by now. The critical thing for voters to take out of this is that the shiny new bauble in the election is not the silver bullet that you think it is. There is only one party big enough to beat the ANC in South Africa's metros. In fact, we are now bigger than the ANC in South Africa's metros. And all we have to do is consolidate the vote behind us, and we turn out to be the biggest party, and we put together coalitions like we did in Cape Town in 2006, and we try to fix the place. It's very hard to fix a failing municipality, no question about that. But Celia Brink was on the road, and his hands would have been profoundly strengthened if all the people who scattered the vote in opposition to the ANC from the National Centre, they scattered their votes across many tiny parties. And this is the result. This is the result.
Can we just step back. Yeah, to address this before we move on, like, who are these people? Like, do you have a handle on how they feel ideologically, demographically? Who are these people who cannot bring themselves to vote ANC, EFF, DA, MK, and insist on voting for these smaller parties? Do they feel that they've got some, understanding that the rest of us don't have? Because it seems to result in nothing but pain for them and for the party that they elect.
Well, that's absolutely true. Now, Hermin has said on the chat, the DA isn't perfect. Well, of course we're not perfect, because we are human beings and none of us is perfect. And I often say to people who say, well, you know, the DA this and the DA that, I say, you know, if you want a perfect party, you need to start your own and see how many people you can get to vote for you. I mean, the DA is anything but perfect. But we've got three things that no other party has got in South Africa, which is why we survive and grow. First of all, we've got a very profound and deep political philosophy that forms the bedrock of everything we do and is the only political philosophy that has led to prosperity and freedom across the world. That's number one. Number two, we have an operational machine that no other party has. We call it the Blue Machine. It works in ways across the entire country, across the entire spectrum of functions of a political party, which is not just running elections. And it works incredibly well. All the wheels and gears complement each other and do what they're supposed to do. And the third thing we've got is the capacity to crowd in talent, real talent. We're not a one-person party like Herman Mashaba is, or two-person, maybe him and Michael Beaumont. And we have got real depth of talent. We've been running a young leaders program since 2006. And we've got people like Celia Brink who come out, and Chris Pappas who come out, and Jordan Hill-Lewis who come out, and Sibiwe Gwahube who come out, and Solly Malatsi who come out. This is depth of talent and skill, because we have an internal meritocracy and we crowd in that talent. And those three factors are what makes the difference. Now, obviously, we're a big party and we attract a lot of support from across the spectrum. And we're not perfect. We're trying the impossible in a country like South Africa to get people from largely different ideologies, backgrounds, cultures, colors, whatever, religions. We're trying to create a common platform of values that we can work together from to build a new majority. And that's a difficult thing to do. And sometimes we're going to say things that people from certain perspectives are not going to like. But in the DA, you can engage that debate, you can argue your corner, and it is very important that we have people arguing that corner. So for Hermin and other people, ask yourself, what impact are you making on the future of your country with your vote? The important thing is to get the kind of country like the DA in pole position to put together coalitions, because coalitions are the future. No party is going to get above 50% again in our metros. Very unlikely. Except
what I'm really interested in hearing, because we've heard some of what Hermin Mashaba had to say, and I think there's something to be learned from what's happened in Tshwane, is your perspective of what went wrong there. What, you know, if you take us a step back and take us behind the scenes and give us your perspective of what went wrong in Tshwane and why it is where it is now. So, because we've heard what Hermin has to say, he's on a junket, you know, about it. And we've seen stuff on social media, but I don't think we've had a view from the perspective of the DA. And I think you're the best placed person to give us that. Can you take us behind the scene and give us some of that background information, context?
Tshwane was always going to be very difficult to turn around. There's no question about that. And we've put an enormous amount of effort into doing so. What went wrong is, A, we didn't get enough votes to have a secure majority at all. I think we had a single seat majority or two seat majority, and it's a very fragile base from which to work. So we need to do our very best to get more votes, and we will do our very best to get more votes, because that is the platform that gives us our strength, if we have any strength. Secondly, we were so unstable over so many years that governments kept changing hands, and the ANC put us under administration. I think it was in 2020 or somewhere around there. And we had just recovered the finances of the city. And of course, the minute the ANC put it under administration before the 2021 local government election, those finances were siphoned off. And that gave us a very, very difficult space from which to operate. And then let me be very honest. I run the DA's governance unit from inside the party. And the single key variable, that determines whether our governments work is this little thing called leadership. People don't often identify it and don't often say that it's a key success factor, but it is the key success factor. We have spent millions from the governance unit's perspective on trying to fix our local governments. And the minute a strong, good leader with integrity and empathy gets into the position, things sort themselves out. So it's that capital L of leadership that is in such short supply. And it's why we run a young leaders program. And it's why we've got all the programs that we are running, like the Catalyst program, which we're introducing for the first time next year, to get new talent, new counselors into our metros and into our, especially our Gauteng metros, because we'd very much like to govern them with really good people after 2026.
All right. Well, I want to ask you about, because I've got an absolute bug up my backside about Alan Windey and climate change in New York. When, I mean, we have such important things to do in this country. We're an oil and coal rich country. It's God knows we've had energy problems for the last 12, 15 years. And this is somehow a priority for him as the Western Cape Premier. We see all kinds of, like, what would you call them, third rail issues that make their way into the DA, which confuse people who are DA voters and people who are not DA voters. And they say, well, what is this? I mean, who's pulling the strings here? Because these are the kinds of priorities you get from the United Nations or from the World Economic Forum. Are these really the priorities of the DA? And why do we waste a single second having to listen to this kind of globalist nonsense coming into a country where we have very practical and in many cases, and I see it happening in home affairs at the moment with that minister, quite soluble problems?
Yes, indeed. Our number one overriding priority must be to grow the economy and get jobs. There's just no question about that. That is South Africa's biggest problem, is unemployment, because unemployment is what leads to the dramatic level of poverty and inequality in our country. So job creation is our number one priority and must be for many decades to come. Interestingly enough, I often thought that the green economy meant job shedding, but when I was Premier of the Western Cape, I learned how many jobs it could create and how much our natural resources of sun and wind and even waves can contribute to a growing economy. And we put an enormous amount of effort into that. And it was one of the reasons that the Western Cape had two stages lower of load shedding than the rest of the country. And it was because of all the small scale embedded generation that was around that could keep businesses open and keep them running when the others across the country had closed. So it was really important to have started that small scale embedded generation program. The liquid natural gas program was also absolutely crucial. And now we have the plan, and the city's already doing that, of Cape Town, is buying back excess electricity that people generate on the roofs of their own houses and then sell back to the city. So it's become an income generator for a lot of families. But critically, and this is the next thing, green energy, which people who can afford it have gone into, and we argue very strongly that there should be a tax rebate for people who go over to generate their own electricity. But green energy, if people stay on the grid, will make energy more affordable for the poor. And that will power all kinds of small businesses in the communities. I heard at the beginning you were talking about the spaza shops. Those are crucial businesses for us. They create jobs. They do a whole range of very important things. They make services accessible to people, like cell phone data and stuff like that. Absolutely critical. But if people go onto green energy and stay on the grid, as we have been urging them to do in the Western Cape and Cape Town, they can then supplement the energy, and then the energy they put into the grid at the feedback tariff is the stuff that other people can use as well, because it goes into everybody's houses and it keeps the price of electricity, we believe, in the medium and longer term, more affordable than this ridiculous NERSA ESCOM increases. So that's our objective. And it was very important that we did that because we had to get the regulatory environment right and all sorts of things. And if you look at Gauteng, for example, many people are switching to solar, but they're not staying on the grid. They're going off the grid. And that makes an enormous difference. So I think in the long term, you'll find that green energy generates just as many jobs as coal.
I don't know.
You know, Gareth, and I'm sorry to keep like bringing us back. I am extremely interested in the way that the GNU, as it's called, the coalition between the ANC and the DA, is working and in some places not working. And so I do want to bring us back to the Swati issue, unfortunately, because it's one of the places where it seems to have a fault line, because now you had a working relationship with Action SA, and that's fallen through, partly also because Herman Mashaba was able to convince your GNU partner at national level to come across and vote with him, right? And much to, you know, some of us looked at it and thought, oh, they won't do that. And the first time around when it was tabled, you know, they collapsed the council and the vote didn't happen. And then they waited for him, for Cyril to be out of the country. And they voted with Herman to oust. So I'm interested to know what that means for the GNU, what's happened in Tshwane, and how the Gauteng provincial executives and their decision to go against national, what that means for the GNU at national level, and what it means at provincial level, where you're trying to get other things through, because there are three rings to the circus, but they don't all seem to be gelling together. So please tell me a little bit about what that means. All this action, primarily, what is the domino effect?
Sure, Pumi. The most important thing there is that it's the ANC's problem, but it becomes our problem. And it becomes the country's problem. There is a big divide between how the ANC at national level and provincial level in Gauteng are facing things. And that vote did send a shockwave through the government of national unity, make no error. And it certainly made the DA sit back and think very hard about possible future options. I'm not going to speak about the government of national unity because it's not my lane. Suffice to say that Lesufi is in great danger. The ANC only got 6 percentage points more than the DA in the 2024 Gauteng election. Only 6 percentage points. Now that is a tiny margin. And again, I will say that if all the voters who voted for a whole slew of tiny little parties had understood the big picture and the importance of ensuring that a strong anchor tenant is at the heart of these coalitions and had voted for the DA, we would have been bigger than the ANC in Gauteng. And that would have changed the ball game completely. But Lesufi is hanging by a thread. Gauteng is a province of metros. It's got Johannesburg, Ekurhuleni, Tshwane and Mogale City. The DA is now officially the biggest party in South Africa's metros if people stop splitting the vote all over the place. And Lesufi knows that we've got, in 2 years, a local government election in which those four metros, although Mogale City isn't formally a metro, But those four metros could fall. And that's his political life on the line. So he's worried about the continued erosion of his base on both sides. And he's decided that he wants to hold on to all of the left-wing EFF's MK-style voters in the run-up to 2026. So that's what's going on. At national level, the president, I think, I haven't spoken to the president, but the president, I think, Fikile Mbalula, David Mukura, and others see a major realignment of politics on the cards. They know that it's very unlikely that single parties are going to get above 50% in forthcoming elections, and that the whole critical thing will be coalitions and alignments. And they know, they very much know, that putting the EFF or MK into government will be the death of good governance and the death of the economy. And if we think that we've got a crisis in unemployment now, we will have to wake up and see what it's going to be like if the EFF and MK come into office.
What do you mean that the GNU is not your lane? What does that mean?
Well, I run the blue machine, right? So I don't run the GNU, I run the blue machine, and my lane is the organization. I just want to see what he says. Somebody said stop blaming the voters. Can you read that one? Because I'd like to stop blaming the voters. You backed the ANC to get Lusufi back into power. The ANC rolled you yet again. Okay, that's an important point from Indy L. Mm-hmm. Indy, we're going to have this government of national unity, and we were going to then have governments of provincial unity, and they were going to be negotiated within the framework of the statement of intent that we'd spent those two difficult weeks negotiating. When we got to Gauteng and the negotiations, it was quite clear that Lusufi had no intention of following those framework agreements. He wanted, out of 14 positions, he wanted the ANC to take 11 when he had just only got 6 percentage points more than the DA. That was the proportionality clause out of the window. He wouldn't tell us which portfolios he was planning to give us. And it turned out that what he was planning to give us was portfolios that had about 2% of the entire Gauteng budget. I said to him, we are here to share power proportionately according to the voters' wishes. We are not here to be co-opted by the ANC. We're not coming in here on your terms. Give and take does not mean that the DA gives and the ANC only takes. You got a very low percentage point in the election. I think if I recall, it was 34%. So you can't dictate the terms anymore. We're the biggest alternative. We're shortly behind you. And you negotiate with us in good faith. And you are transparent. Tell us, we've got to discuss which portfolios we take. And he was quite honest, you know. He said to someone who I trust implicitly that Lusufi had said to them, we can't possibly give the DA education or health because they'll get in there, they'll run it properly, and they'll win votes. That's what he said. So that's why they have to keep us out of these portfolios. And I'm not blaming the voters. I'm just saying that people get the government they deserve. That's all. People get the government they voted for. So voters can't sit back and say, we spread our vote all over the place. The DA must now come and give us DA governance. We can only give you DA governance if we get enough votes. That's the only point I'm making. No blaming of voters, just a simple democratic fact.
So since the election, you know, there's quite a lot of buzz. I mean, I think if anything, what's happened after the election and how the coalition and the DA and the ANC have come to this point has created a lot of talkability. So there's lots of talk within the media, on social media, and I assume also at dinner parties about all of the various things that are happening. And with regard to the party, the DA, not all of them good. And one of the things that even somebody in the comments has just asked about is what's happening inside the party, because it seems a little bit like the tail is wagging the dog, with regard to how you have responded, I would say, with the Ronaldo Hoss experience. And now, very recently, with what's happened with Roman within the party. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that and kind of the party's thinking around how that played out and what it means for the party?
The Roman issue had nothing to do with the party. That was a government issue. And I'm not going to talk about what happened in the government and issues like that. That is not my lane, as I've said. The Ronaldo Hoss issue was very clear. We run a party according to our rules and our constitution. And if someone is accused of misconduct under the rules and the constitution, they get a fair hearing before a DA panel. And always on that panel, there are people who are legally trained and understand what due process is, understand what audi alteram partem is, and give people a fair chance. We said nothing about Ronaldo's guilt or innocence until the panel reported and the report came to the federal executive. The federal executive hasn't got any power to hear a case or to find someone guilty or not guilty. The federal executive can only look out at the facts that are contained in the report, that have been tested, that have been subject to cross-examination, and that have been subject to the right to state your own case, the Audi rule. The federal executive looks at that full report and looks at the proposals for sanction that the panel, the judicial panel, makes. And the judicial panel considers extenuating circumstances, aggravating circumstances. They put it all together and they make a proposal to the federal executive. The panel on Ronaldo Hoss was split. One part of the panel said, make him delete all his social media accounts and do that sort of thing. And the other said, he's got to lose his membership. This was so egregious. Now, I don't want to go into all of the things that were prosecuted and decided in that particular report. But it is important to note that when Ronaldo was first confronted by several people about that video, he denied that he'd made it. And he said that it must have been fake news generated by AI. So that was obviously an aggravating circumstance. And there were several others. And after a long discussion, and the federal executive went through that report carefully, after a long discussion, the resolve was that the loss of membership was the appropriate sanction in that case. So it went through a full and proper hearing. It went through a full and proper hearing in front of a fair panel. And the federal executive went through the report on the screen carefully and then resolved that it was impossible for the DA to continue having a person who could express those views, even though the context was taken into account, because there was a specific context about that, and context is always very important. But the use of some words are so egregious that it's really incompatible with who we are.
Wow. You know, and obviously now, because it's not only, it used to be that before you had to get an interview, you had to be on TV or in a newspaper for some of this feedback loop for people who feel aggrieved in any way. But now with social media and YouTube and all of that, everybody's got their own megaphone that they can put out there. And I don't know if you've seen the Randall Williams video yet? Have you seen the newsroom footage of Randall Williams that he put out,
I've seen some snippets.
And he has quite a, for those of the listeners and viewers today who haven't seen it, he makes quite a lot of allegations about how he was treated within, when he was the mayor of Tshwane, how he was treated within the party and what he was asked to do and who he was asked to report to, and varying stakeholders, black stakeholders, white stakeholders, and all of that kind of stuff. And when I saw that yesterday, I thought, wow, here's another, yet another person coming out of the DA feeling aggrieved by whatever processes happened inside and making the same allegations that were made by Musi Maimane, that were made by Phumzile when she left, that all of these various people. And I'm interested to know, why do you think that all of these individuals, when they are now outside the party, this is the way they respond and these are the things they say about the party? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are numerous reasons, but I think the main reason is that the zeitgeist valorizes victimhood. And if you can paint yourself as a victim, then you become a hero. Many of these people are excoriated and criticized by commentators while they're in the DA. And the minute they leave the DA and say something rude about the DA, they become a hero. And the only black people in the DA who are ever noticed are those that leave the DA. You're not talking to me about the hundreds of people who've come to the DA, the many, many more black leaders who've grown up now in the DA than the ones who have left, because the media only make an issue of a black leader in the DA when they leave. They never give them a platform when they're actually there. Now, let's just focus on Randall. Randall is treated like every other mayor. Randall was the first DA mayor who got us such a negative audit outcome. Now, I know it wasn't only his fault, and I know things had a historical legacy. But the critical issue was that Randall had not given us any prior notice that there was going to be this extremely bad outcome. And he knew about it in the November of 2023, and we had ample interactions with him at the end of 2023. And we only learned just before the Auditor General's report was going to come out in 2024, I think it was. I hope my dates are right. They may be, they may not be. Now, I think it's probably 2022, if I think very carefully on this. Anyway, it was 2022. And then going into 2023. Now, one thing you've got to understand, the DA is there to support you all the time, but we need to know what's going on. And we need our mayors to level with us. And he said that he still wanted to try and speak to the Auditor General to resolve some outstanding issues. But the audit outcome was so profoundly negative that someone had to be held to account. Obviously, Mr. Bunda, who was then the chief financial officer of Tshwane, was fired, but there was further accountability because all the indicators were moving in the wrong direction for Tshwane. And we could see that things were unraveling, and we had a duty to request him to resign. It's not a terrible thing to do. He'd lost the confidence of his caucus in any event. And that was the request, irrespective of his race. It had nothing to do with race. And he did write a resignation letter. It was sent to me, but there's nothing unusual or bizarre about that. I mean, if the worst thing that you can say is that a resignation letter was sent to Zilla, well, there we go. And the critical and important thing is that when Celia took over, we saw real leadership come into play, and it made a real difference. Suddenly, there was the capital L in Tshwane, the capital L being leadership. And, you know, I like Randall. I really do like Randall. I've never had a bad word between him and me. Never, ever. But some people have the capital L and some people don't. And it is just so critical in leading a broken municipality to recovery.
So he's chosen the L of liar, is what you're saying.
No, I mean, you know, I don't know what he was lying about. I mean, Solly disputes very strongly the things that he said about Solly. And obviously, you know, it's not a big deal.
Is he still in the party?
No, he isn't. He lets his membership lapse, which is also fine. No problem. No issue. And, you know, people let their membership lapse. You know, it's a voluntary association, a political party. People come and go.
And so what does the future look like if we can, if you can stare into that crystal ball, or rather, as you said at the beginning, the trends, if you read the trends of this partnership that you've got with the ANC, imperfect as it may be, what does the trend look like for this partnership at national level going into 2029, but more importantly, going into the local general election? Do you think that this partnership has life in it and can yield something for voters? Should people be looking at kind of a future where there is this uneasy partnership that can deliver for them? Or are you hoping that going into the local general election, more people will vote for you, then you don't, you can discard the partnership?
Well, the DA's key brand attribute is that we are better in government. And where the DA governs, things do get better for all people. More jobs are created, unemployment comes down, the electricity stays on, you don't have sewage in your water, all the things that really matter to people, potholes get fixed, that sort of thing. And when we take over a broken municipality, it takes time to get all of that basic stuff right, but we do get it right eventually. Now, we're a party about governance, right? And more people are going to start realizing how important that is. Water is going to be the country's next major, major crisis. And in Gauteng, it's going to be particularly bad. And if you think an economy can't run without electricity, try making an economy run without water. You can't do that. So more and more, this concept of who is better at government is going to become existential for South Africa, and most particularly for South Africa's cities. Now, both the ANC and the DA got a big electoral bounce through the GNU. People like the GNU. 66% of people of all races support the DA's presence in the GNU. So we got a big electoral bounce in terms of support through the GNU, but then so did the ANC as well. And the critical thing is, can the ANC hold together all its warring factions? I spoke to you earlier about the three things that make a party survive and grow, those three things being a core political philosophy, an organizational machine, and the capacity to crowd in talent. Those are the three critical legs on which a political party stands and grows and thrives. If you look at the ANC, they've got none of them. They don't have a core political philosophy. What is the ANC's political philosophy? They stretch from EFF-type totalitarians on the one side to probably constitutionalists on the other side, but it's a whole inchoate mess. They don't have a default political philosophy. That's a huge weakness in a party, because they haven't got a set of core policies that guides them, or core principles that guide them in every decision they make, whether it's a policy decision, whether it's an action, whatever it is. The second thing is they no longer have a machine. That machine is in tatters. It can't function. It only works on patronage. And the minute you lose power, patronage no longer works, you see. And that's why when the ANC loses power, it goes backwards at such a rapid rate. And the third thing is they can't crowd in talent. They can't crowd in talent, because talent knows that they will get nowhere if they're not properly connected. Somebody in the ANC, and I was in the ANC many years ago in the I was a big supporter of theirs in the 1980s. Somebody said to me, why is it that a person, let's say like Jordan Hill Lewis or Chris Pappas, don't come to the ANC? I said, well, why would they? First of all, they know that their skill and capacity would never be recognized. They would have to be at least 60 before they got anywhere. And you don't have a meritocratic process of candidate selection. They would have to be 65 before they got anywhere. And they're the wrong color. They're the wrong gender. Their biology, their identity counts against them. Why would they? You've got to be in a party that recognizes merit, that recognizes talent, and that gets people like Liam Jacobs, like Siliwe Gwahube, like Soli Malatsi, all up to the top on the basis of their talent and skill and the amount of work they're prepared to do.
So what is, do you think more people are going to vote for the DA in the local general election?
Well, you know, people must make up their mind. Do they want the DA to be putting together governments in their municipalities, or do they want Lusufi to be? That's the choice. Let's
just talk quickly about some of the ministers in the Government of National Unity. I know that you can't speak on behalf of government, but from the DA point of view, which ministers do you think are already making headway? We're already 100 days into the GNU. If you've got any PR stories to tell, then this is the opportunity. And also, are there some letdowns here? Are there some things that that perhaps, you know, the voters for the DA might be disappointed in?
Well, let me say that Home Affairs has been very, very pleasantly surprising. You know, I thought it was a lost cause. Leon is incredibly smart and incredibly strategic. And it's also fortunately the portfolio which has the least codependencies. He doesn't depend on a whole lot of other departments to do things. Siviwe in hers sits there with the power to create frameworks and norms and standards, but no power over the provinces where the real decisions are taken in the practical sphere of education. So she has to live with a lot of codependencies, which is a very difficult thing to do. Ditto Solly Malatsi. But Leon has got this almost nice, discreetly defined and shaped portfolio in Home Affairs, and he's moving it. You know, he's really moving it, and he's going to digitize it. It's going to take 5 years at least to digitize, probably longer, but he's got the backlog under control. He's going to finish the backlog before Christmas, and the queues are starting to move again. Things are starting to happen. The corruption is getting rooted out, so that's really great. And Home Affairs hits everybody's life in South Africa at some point or another. And then we've got Dion George. He's going around doing his thing all over the place. And, you know, he's going to have a huge impact on the economy. He's already moving on the small harbors, which got totally bogged down under the ANC ministers. And just speaking for the Western Cape, if he, with the local authorities, can get those small harbors right along our coastline pumping, that's lots of new jobs that are going to be created. John Steenhuisen, as Minister of Agriculture, has been all over the world expanding our export markets and making sure that, you know, we can actually export our stuff. The big blockage there, the big codependency, is the collapse of our ports. And so that's where Dean McPherson comes in. He's got to make sure that those ports are able to function properly and export our farmers' produce, which is world-class, but it shouldn't sit and rot in the harbors. So altogether, Dean's also doing a huge job in getting the construction mafia under control. So these things are incredibly important and all come together to create improved government over time. But it doesn't happen instantly. It really doesn't happen instantly. Turning around an ANC mess takes a lot of effort, a lot of teamwork, and a lot of time.
Helen, I need to understand also, and this may be going back quite a little bit, but who are your main interlocutors when it comes to putting together these deals, making sure that the coalitions hold? Who do you pick up the phone and talk to in the ANC?
Well, the right person for me to talk to is Fikile Mbalula, and I talked to him quite a lot. I found him to be actually very amenable, and he can listen as much as he can speak, which is a very good thing. And he's much more nuanced and reflective than I expected him to be. So I've built up what I think is quite a constructive relationship with Fikile. Then David Makura, well, we know each other since we were both premiers. He was premier of Gauteng and I was premier of the Western Cape. And we had a very good relationship then. It was critical for South Africa that Gauteng succeeded. And I did my best to share as much as we could with Gauteng so that both Gauteng and the Western Cape could succeed, because it was very, very critical for South Africa. And I've always got on very well with David Makura. So we've got a good relationship. During the negotiations, I also came across Phoebe Potgieter in detail for the first time. And I must say I developed a very high regard for her. She's incredibly strategic and smart. And she's also just driven by her passion for South Africa and South Africa succeeding. So those are the main people that I dealt with, and they all sort of joined by the same commitment for South Africa's success.
And then Congo Chris is not going to let you go unless you at least give us an answer, even if your answer is this is outside of your ambit. But Bella and the NHI, because these are things that your DA voters do not like, and yet it seems this is something that you're going to have to compromise on.
Well, let me just say this. We will never rubber stamp Bella and the NHI, Congo Chris. That's never been the option. Let me just tell you what's on the front page of Die Burger today. My husband has just brought it in because he shows me when I get into trouble. I'm always on the front page of the newspaper. Where is this thing? No, it's there.
There.
That's where it is.
Laura and Flossie beat.
Not where it is. Sorry, I'm trying to find where it is. Hold on.
Just read it to her.
It is that Skjering story.
Okay, so it's the main headline. Skjering funny government and national unity is no what?
It says Skjering van RNE definitief moontlik. So that is a split in the government of national unity is possible. And the follow-up is DA is nie daarom gekoopteer te word nie.
All right, so then the proof will be in the pudding. I mean, how much, you know, this is such a difficult question. I don't expect you to answer it in a sentence, but how much give and take is there going on here? Because we were all, you know, filled with hope and optimism and all of that stuff at the beginning of this situation with the government and national unity. We see some ministers cooperating nicely. We see certain things going in the direction that most people in this country, ANC or DA or anything else, would probably hope to see things. But what are the non-negotiables from your point of view? Like what could the ANC do that would be an absolute deal breaker?
Well, if it started forcing people to close down their medical end. You know, I can't say, you know, I'm not leading the government. That's the worrying thing. I'm not leading the government, right? It's good probably that I'm not leading the government, but
because you said that's the worrying thing.
Well, you see, the worrying thing is that I can't talk on the government, right?
Yeah.
I can't talk on the government if I'm not in the government.
Gotcha.
And so every time I start talking in the government, I'm out of my lane and I shouldn't do that. That's the worrying thing.
Speaking of your lane, another criticism that's always leveled at you, which, you know, when is it time for Helen to give it up? Because obviously you have performed an absolutely pivotal role inside of the DA for a very, very long time. They regard you very highly, which is why you end up having to make the call on so many important things. You're obviously also behind the scenes in a lot of ways, kind of helping people along because you've got the experience of government in the Western Cape and opposition politics for however many years. But when have you had enough? Because I know I've read your books. I know that you're as tough as nails. But when are you going to eventually say, you know what, actually, I'm done with this nonsense. You know, shut down your Twitter account and go and enjoy your life.
Well, I won't shut down my Twitter account. I'll become much more loquacious when I'm not in this position, I can assure you.
Oh, that's going to set everybody's hair is going to catch fire if you say that.
I think so. Anyway, the bottom line is that I have two of the most magnificent grandchildren you can imagine. Of course, I'm a most objective grandmother, as you can also imagine.
Sure.
And every time I'm with them and taking them out and doing things, I think, oh, I must give up this other thing. But, you know, I'll go when I'm completely convinced that the DEA has such a depth of leadership that it's not going to make any difference.
Okay, and we're not there yet, huh?
We're getting there. We're getting there very quickly. We weren't there in 2015 when I stepped down.
All right. Well, thank you for your time this morning. It's always valuable to speak to you, Helen. And, you know, there are people in the comment section here who said you can't really argue with Helen. I don't know. I think you're the kind of person that people like to argue with. Sometimes they win, very rarely. A lot of the time they lose, but I appreciate the fact that you're always willing to talk about these things. And it's an unenviable position. I wouldn't want it. So well done.
You know, my only thing is, how is South Africa going to become a success? That's my only motivating thing. It's the only thing that drives me. My life has had that single purpose the whole way along. I joined up with the Progressive Party in 1967. So in 2027, I will have been in this rodeo for 60 years. And, you know, I love it. And I am totally committed to this country, and it can work. We've got what it takes, and we have to make it function.
Well, Congo Chris's last word. I don't think John is ready yet. Keep Helen. Right. Thank you so much, Helen Zilla from the Democratic Alliance. Pumi Mashiho, we will return for another episode of The Burning Platform. Same time next week, and we'll have lots more to talk about too. Thanks, everybody, and thank you for being part of the show. Cheers. Enjoy your Thursday.
Thanks so much for the comments. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.